richer, their temples and the images in them grew grander and more refined. Though the former stayed true to the U-shape and sunken plaza pattern I saw in the Norte Chico, and the latter, depicted often in the staff god pose, never lost their erect postures, gnashing fangs, and brandished staffs. Over the millennia, this god or gods transmuted into Viracocha, the Inca creator deity, whose worship was brutally suppressed by Spain. Whether on the coast or in the river valleys, Mosley said, the Norte Chico lighted a cultural fire. During the next 3,000 years, Peru hosted so many diverse cultures that the archaeological timelines in textbooks, with their multiple arrows and switchbacks, are as impenetrable as the family trees of European kings. Despite their variousness, Haas says, all seem to have drawn in their diverse ways from the well of Norte Chico. Characterizing the similarities is as difficult as nailing down a blob of mercury, because exceptions abound and human behavior is always multifaceted. Nonetheless, visitors to Andean history note certain ways of doing things that recur in ways striking to the outsider, sometimes in one variant, sometimes in another, like the themes in a jazz improvisation. The primacy of exchange over a wide area, the penchant for collective, festive civic work projects, the high valuation of textiles and textile technology, Norte Chico, it seems possible to say, set the template for all of them. And only Norte Chico. For the next 4,000 years, Andean civilization was influenced by only one major import from the world outside, maize. A few other minor crops made the trip later, including tobacco, domesticated in Amazonia, then exported north to become the favorite vice of Indians from Mesoamerica to Maine. But it is a mark of maize's social, cultural, and even political centrality that it was the first, and for centuries the only, phenomenon to pass from Mexico to the Andes. The next major import, alas, was smallpox. Tiny cobs. Although it was just after dawn, several people were already waiting outside the small store. When the metal grating rolled up, I followed them inside. The shop was in a middle-class neighborhood of Oaxaca City in southern Mexico. Behind the low counter, half a dozen women hovered over waist-high stoves made of concrete block. Recessed into the dome-shaped top of each stove were two shallow clay dishes that served as burners. With expert motions, the women slipped tortillas, thin discs of cream-colored flour, perhaps 9 inches in diameter, onto the hot burners. In seconds, the tortilla dried and puffed up like a souffle. And from the storefront floated the aroma of toasting maize, which has permeated Mexico and Central America for thousands of years. Established in 2001, the tortilla store is an innovative attempt to preserve one of Earth's greatest cultural and biological assets, the many local varieties of maize in the narrow waste of southern Mexico. The isthmus is a medley of mountains, beaches, wet tropical forests, and dry savannas, and is the most ecologically diverse area in Mesoamerica. Some parts of Oaxaca go up 9,000 feet, T. Boone Hallberg, a botanist at the Oaxaca Institute of Technology, told me. Other parts are at sea level. Sometimes the soil is very acid, sometimes it's quite basic, all within a few hundred feet. You can go on either side of a highway, and the climate will be different on the east side than on the west side. The area's human geography is equally diverse. It is the home of more than a dozen major Indian groups, who have a long and fractious history. Despite the strife among them, all of them played a role in the region's greatest achievement, the development of Mesoamerican agriculture, arguably the world's most ecologically savvy form of farming, and of its centerpiece, Zia maize, the crop known to agronomists as maize. I was visiting Amado Ramirez Leiva, the entrepreneur behind the tortilla store. Born in Oaxaca and trained as an agronomist, Ramirez Leiva had established a consortium of traditional farmers, Indians like himself. Ramirez Leiva is Nisawi, Mixtec, the second most numerous Indian group in the region. The farmer supplied 8 different varieties of dried maize to his shop. Itanoni, where the kernels are carefully ground, hand-pressed into tortillas, and cooked fresh for customers. Itanoni means maize flour in Nasawi, and refers to a flour that blooms in maize fields. It is one of the few tortillerias in Mexico, perhaps even the only one, to sell what might be described as estate tortillas, proudly labeled as being made from maize of one variety, from one area. Everyone in Mexico knows the rules for making a true tortilla, Ramirez Leyva told me. But you can't get them that way now, except maybe in your grandmother's kitchen. First soak the dried maize kernels in a bath of lime and water to remove their thin, translucent skins. A process with its own special verb, nixtamalizar. Then stone grind the kernels into masa, a light, slightly sticky paste with a distinct maize fragrance. Made without salt, spices, leavening, or preservatives, masa must be cooked within a few hours of being ground, and the tortilla should be eaten soon after it's cooked. Hot is best, perhaps folded over with mushrooms or cheese in a tlacoyo. Like a glass of wine, he said, a tortilla should carry the flavor of its native place. You want to try some? I did. The smells in the shop, dry toasted maize, melting farm cheese, squash flour sautéing in home-pressed oil, were causing my stomach to direct urgent messages to my brain. Ramirez Leyva gave me a plateful of tlacoyos. This is exactly what you would have eaten here 10,000 years ago, he said. In his enthusiasm, he was overstating, but not by much. Indians didn't have cheese, for one thing, and they didn't eat tortillas 10,000 years ago, though tortillas are indeed ancient. It is known that 11,500 years ago, Paleo-Indians were hunting from caves in what is now Puebla, the state northwest of Oaxaca. These were not mastodon and mammoth hunters. Both species were already extinct. Instead, they preyed on deer, horse, antelope, jackrabbit, and now and then, giant turtle, as well as several species of rodent. Within the next 2,000 years, all of these animals except deer vanished too, done in either by a local variant of overkill, the onset of hotter, drier conditions that shrank the available grassland, or both. Responding to the lack of game, people in Oaxaca and Puebla focused more on gathering. Shifting among productive locations, individual families living on their own ate seeds and fruit during the spring and fall and hunted during the winter. During the summer, they joined together in bands of 25 to 30. Cactus leaves, a local favorite, were plentiful enough in that season to support larger groups. All the while, their store of knowledge about the environment increased. People learned how to make agave plants edible, roast them, how to remove the tannic acid from acorns, grind them to a powder, then soak, how to make tongs to pick spiny cactus fruit, how to find wild squash flowers in the undergrowth, and other useful things. Along the way, perhaps, they noticed that seeds thrown in the garbage one year would sprout spontaneously in the next. The sum of these questions led to full-fledged agriculture. Not just in the Tehuacán Valley, but in many places in southern Mexico. Squashes, gourds, peppers, and chupandilla plums were among the initial crops. The first cereal was probably millet. Not the millet eaten today, which originated in Africa, but a cousin species, knotweed bristlegrass, which is no longer farmed. And then came maize. At the DNA level, all the major cereals, wheat, rice, maize, millet, barley, and so on, are surprisingly alike. But despite their genetic similarity, maize looks and acts different from the rest. It is like the one red-headed early riser in a family of dark-haired night owls. Left untended, other cereals are capable of propagating themselves. Because maize kernels are wrapped inside a tough husk, human beings must sow the species. It essentially cannot reproduce on its own. The uncultivated ancestors of other cereals resemble their domesticated descendants. People can and do eat their grain. In the Middle East, for example, The wild barley harvest from a small piece of land can feed a family. By contrast, no wild maize ancestor has ever been found, despite decades of search. Maize's closest relative is a mountain grass called teosinte that looks nothing like it. Teosinte splits into many thin stems, whereas maize has a single thick stalk. And teosinte, unlike wild wheat and rice, is not a practical food source. Its ears are scarcely an inch long and consist of 7 to 12 hard, woody seeds. An entire ear of teosinte has less nutritional value than a single kernel of modern maize. The grain in wild grasses develops near the top of the stem. As it matures, the stem slowly breaks up, shatters in the jargon, letting the seed dribble to the ground. In wild wheat and barley, a common single gene mutation blocks shattering. For the plant, the change is highly disadvantageous, but it facilitates harvest by humans. The grain waits on the stem to be collected. The discovery and planting of non-shattering grain is thought to have been integral to the Neolithic Revolution in the Middle East. Like other grasses, teosinte shatters, but there is no known non-shattering variant. At least 16 genes control teosinte and maize shattering, a situation so complex that geneticists have effectively thrown up their hands after trying to explain how a non-shattering type might have appeared spontaneously. No known wild ancestor, no obvious natural way to evolve a non-shattering variant, no way to propagate itself. Little wonder that the Mexican National Museum of Culture claimed in a 1982 exhibition that maize was not domesticated, but created, almost from scratch. In the 1960s, Richard S. McNeish of Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, led an archaeological team that meticulously combed Puebla's Tehuacan Valley for signs of early agriculture. Like the Peruvian littoral, the Tehuacan Valley lies in a double rain shadow, sandwiched between two mountain ranges. The aridity similarly helps preserve archaeological evidence. McNeish's team sifted through 50 caves before they found anything. In site number 50, a rock shelter near the village of Coscatlan, the team found maize cobs the size of a cigarette butt. Ultimately, McNeish's team found 23,607 whole or partial maize cobs in five caves in the Tehuacan Valley. This ancient refuse became ammunition in a long-running academic battle between Harvard botanist Paul C. Mangelsdorf and George Beadle, a geneticist who worked at Stanford, Caltech, and the University of Chicago. In the late 1930s, both men proposed theories about the origin of maize. Mangelsdorf said that it descended from the mix of a now-vanished wild ancestor of maize and wild grasses from the genus Trypsicum. Teosinte, he said, played no role in its development. Beadle had a simpler theory. Maize was directly descended from teosinte. Mangelsdorf treated this idea with disbelieving scorn. By now, the reader will not be surprised to learn that an apparently arcane debate about the distant past could become vehemently personal. Relations between the two men became cold, then bitter, then explosive. Botanists chose sides and wrote caustic letters about each other. Mangelsdorf worked with McNeish and classified the 23,607 ancient maize cobs. The smallest and oldest, he proclaimed, were maize's true wild ancestor, which Indians had then crossed with Trypsicum to make modern maize. So powerful did the evidence of Mangelsdorf's tiny cob seem that in the 1960s it buried the teosinte hypothesis. Even though the latter's champion, Beadle, had for other research won a Nobel Prize. Beadle's ideas were taken up in revamped form by University of Wisconsin botanist Hugh Iltis in 1970. Maize originated, Iltis postulated, in a strange wholesale mutation of teosinte, to which Indians added and subtracted features through intensive breeding. Mangelsdorf's side found itself on the defensive. Iltis had gleefully pointed out that the wild maize cobs from the Tehuacan Valley were identical to those of an unusual, fully domesticated variety of popcorn from Argentina. By then, the dispute over the origin of maize had filled almost as much paper and became as acrimonious as the battle over Clovis. In 1997, Mary W. Eubanks, a Duke University biologist, resuscitated the hybridization theory in a new variant. Maize, she suggested, might have been created by repeatedly crossing Zea diploperennis, a rare maize relative, and another cousin species, eastern gammagrass. When species from different genera hybridize, the result can be what the biologist, Barbara McClintock, called genomic shock. A wholesale reordering of DNA in which new species can arise quite suddenly. In Eubanks' theory, Indians came upon a chance combination of Zea diploperennis and gammagrass, and realized that by mixing these two species, they could shape an entirely new biological entity. As proof, she announced the creation of a Zea diploperennis gammagrass hybrid in the laboratory that displayed the attributes of ancient maize. The Teosinte faction remained skeptical. A consortium of 12 maize scientists harshly attacked Eubanks' work in 2001 for, in their view, failing to demonstrate that her hybrid was actually a Zea diploperennis gammagrass mix, and not an accidental blend of Zea diploperennis and modern maize. Such errors are a constant threat. In a busy lab, it is all too easy for biologists to use the wrong pollen, mislabel a tray, or mistake one analysis for another. Meanwhile, other geneticists pinpointed Teosinte mutations that could have led to modern maize, including Sugary1, a variant gene that alters maize starch in a way that gives tortillas the light, flaky texture celebrated at Itinoni. Because maize is many steps removed from Teosinte, these scientists argued that the modern species had to have been consciously developed by a small group of breeders who hunted through Teosinte stands for plants with the desired traits. Geneticists from Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, estimated in 1998 that determined, aggressive, knowledgeable plant breeders, which Indians certainly were, might have been able to breed maize in as little as a decade by seeking the right Teosinte mutations. From the historian's point of view, the difference between the two models is unimportant. In both, Indians took the first steps toward modern maize in southern Mexico, probably in the highlands, more than 6,000 years ago. Both argue that modern maize was the outcome of a bold act of conscious biological manipulation. Arguably man's first and perhaps his greatest feat of genetic engineering, Nina V. Fedoroff, a geneticist at Pennsylvania State University, wrote in 2003. Fedoroff's description, which appeared in Science, intrigued me. "It makes 21st century scientists sound like pikers," I said when I contacted her. "That's right," she said. "To get corn out of Teosinte is so... you couldn't get a grant to do that now because it would sound so crazy." She added, "Somebody who did that today would get a Nobel Prize, if their lab didn't get shut down by Greenpeace, I mean." To people accustomed to thinking of maize in terms of dark or light yellow kernels of corn on the cob, the variety in Mexican maize is startling. Red, blue, yellow, orange, black, pink, purple, creamy white, multicolored. The jumble of colors in Mesoamerican maize reflects the region's jumble of cultures and ecological zones. One place may have maize with cobs the size of a baby's hand, and little red kernels no bigger than grains of rice that turn into tiny puffs when popped. In another valley will be maize with 2-foot-long cobs with great puffy kernels that Mexicans float in soup like croutons. "Every variety has its own special use," Ramirez Leyva explained to me. "This one is for holidays, this one makes tortillas, this one for nicuatole, a kind of maize gelatin, this one for tejate, a cold drink in which maize flour, mame pits, fermented white cacao beans, and other ingredients are marinated in water overnight and then sweetened and whipped to a froth." As a rule, domesticated plants are less genetically diverse than wild species because breeders try to breed out characteristics they don't want. Maize is one of the few farm species that is more diverse than most wild plants. More than 50 genetically distinguishable maize land races have been identified in Mexico, of which at least 30 are native to Oaxaca, according to Flavio Aragon Cuevas, a maize researcher at the Oaxaca office of the National Institute for Forestry, Agriculture, and Fisheries Research. A landrace is a family of local varieties, each of which may have scores of cultivars, or cultivated varieties. As many as 5,000 cultivars may exist in Mesoamerica. Maize is open-pollinated. It scatters pollen far and wide. Wheat and rice discreetly pollinate themselves. Because wind frequently blows pollen from one small maize field onto another, varieties are constantly mixing. Maize is terribly promiscuous. Hugo Perales, an agronomist at the think tank Ecosur in Chiapas, told me, uncontrolled open pollination would, over time, turn the species into a single, relatively homogeneous entity. But it does not, because farmers carefully sort through the seed they will sow in the next season, and generally do not choose obvious hybrids. Thus, there is both a steady flow of genes among maize landraces and a force counteracting that flow. The varieties are not like islands, carefully apart, Perales explained. They are more like gentle hills in a landscape. You see them, they are clearly present, but you cannot specify precisely where they start. San Juan Chamula, a mountain town in central Chiapas, near the border with Guatemala, is an example. Located outside the colonial city of San Cristóbal de las Casas, it has a 16th century church with a brilliant blue interior that is a popular tourist destination. But beyond the souvenir kiosks in the cathedral square, most of the 44,000 inhabitants of Chamula scratch a living from the dry mountain slopes outside town. Almost all are Tzotzil, a southwestern branch of the Maya. In 1995, the most recent date for which census data are available, about 28,000 did not speak Spanish. According to a survey by Perales, 85% of the farmers plant the same maize landraces as their fathers, varieties that have been passed on and maintained for generations. The crop in the field today is the sum of thousands of individual choices made by community members in the past. Indian farmers grow maize in what is called a milpa. The term means maize field, but refers to something considerably more complex. A milpa is a field, usually but not always recently cleared, in which farmers plant a dozen crops at once, including maize, avocados, multiple varieties of squash and bean, melon, tomatoes, chilies, sweet potato, jicama, a tuber, amaranth, a grain-like plant, and mucuna, a tropical legume. In nature, wild beans and squash often grow in the same field as teosinte, the beans using the tall teosinte as a ladder to climb toward the sun. Below ground, the beans' nitrogen-fixing roots provide nutrients needed by teosinte. The milpa is an elaboration of this natural situation, unlike ordinary farms, which involve single-crop expanses of a sort rarely observed in unplowed landscapes. Milpa crops are nutritionally and environmentally complementary. Maize lacks digestible niacin, the amino acids lysine and tryptophan necessary to make proteins, and diets with too much maize can lead to protein deficiency and pellagra, a disease caused by lack of niacin. Beans have both lysine and tryptophan, but not the amino acids cysteine and methionine, which are provided by maize. As a result, beans and maize make a nutritionally complete meal. Squashes, for their part, provide an array of vitamins. Avocados, fats. The milpa, in the estimation of H. Garrison Wilkes, a maize researcher at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, is one of the most successful human inventions ever created. Wilkes was referring to the ecological worries that beset modern agribusiness. Because agricultural fields are less diverse than natural ecosystems, they cannot perform all their functions. As a result, farm soils can rapidly become exhausted. In Europe and Asia, farmers try to avoid stressing the soil by rotating crops, They may plant wheat one year, legumes the next, and let the field lie fallow in the year following. But in many places, this only works for a while, or it is economically unfeasible not to use the land for a year. Then farmers use artificial fertilizer, which at best is expensive, and at worst may inflict long-term damage on the soil. No one knows how long this system can continue. The milpa, by contrast, has a long record of success. There are places in Mesoamerica that have been continuously cultivated for 4,000 years and are still productive, Wilkes told me. The milpa is the only system that permits that kind of long-term use. Likely, the milpa cannot be replicated on an industrial scale. But by studying its essential features, researchers may be able to smooth the rough ecological edges of conventional agriculture. Mesoamerica still has much to teach us, Wilkes said. To Wilkes's way of thinking, ancient Indian farming methods may be the cure for some of modern agriculture's ailments. Beginning in the 1950s, scientists developed hybrid strains of wheat, rice, maize, and other crops that were vastly more productive than traditional varieties. The combination of the new crops and the greatly increased use of artificial fertilizer and irrigation led to the well-known Green Revolution. In many ways, the Green Revolution was a tremendous boon. Harvests in many poor countries soared so fast that despite burgeoning populations, the incidence of hunger fell dramatically. Unfortunately, though, the new hybrids are almost always more vulnerable to disease and insects than older varieties. In addition to being too costly for many small farmers, the fertilizer and irrigation can, if used improperly, damage the soil. Worst, perhaps, in the long run, the exuberant spread of the Green Revolution has pushed many traditional cultivars toward extinction, which in turn reduces the genetic diversity of crops. Wilkes believes that some or all of these difficulties may be resolved by reproducing features of the milpa in a contemporary setting. If this occurs, it will be the second time that the dissemination of Mesoamerican agricultural techniques will have had an enormous cultural impact. The first time being, of course, when they originated. From today's vantage, it is difficult to imagine the impact maize must have had in southern Mexico at the beginning. But perhaps a comparison will help. Almost pure stands of einkorn wheat covered dozens of square kilometers in Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and other parts of the Middle East, according to Jack R. Harlan and Daniel Zoery, two agronomists who pored over the area in the 1960s to determine the distribution of wild cereals. Over many thousands of hectares in those countries, they wrote in Science, it would be possible to harvest wild wheat today from natural stands almost as dense as a cultivated wheat field. In the Middle East, therefore, the impact of agriculture was thus less a matter of raising the productivity of wheat, barley, and other cereals, than of extending the range in which they could be grown. By developing varieties that could flourish in climates and soils that daunt the wild plant. By contrast, the Americas had no wild maize, and thus no wild maize harvest. Stands of teosinte have been seen in the wild, but because the ears are tiny and constantly shattering, they are difficult to harvest. Thus, before agriculture, the people of Mesoamerica had never experienced what it was like to stand in a field of grain. Grain fields, landscapes of food, were part of the mental furniture of people in Mesopotamia. They were an astounding novelty in Mesoamerica. Indians not only created a new species, they created a new environment to put it in. Unsurprisingly, the reverberations sounded for centuries. Maize in the milpa, the Yale archaeologist Michael D. Coe wrote, is the key to the understanding of Mesoamerican civilization. Where it flourished, so did high culture. The statement may be more precise than it seems. In the 1970s, the geographer Ann Kirkby discovered that Indian farmers in Oaxaca considered it not worth their while to clear and plant a milpa unless it could produce more than about 200 pounds of grain per acre. Using this figure, Kirkby went back to the ancient cobs excavated from the Tehuacan Valley and tried to estimate how much grain per acre they would have yielded. The cob sizes steadily increased as they approached the present. In Kirkby's calculation, the harvest broke the magic 200-pound line sometime between 2000 and 1500 BC. At about that time, the first evidence of large-scale land clearing for milpas appears in the archaeological record. And with it appeared the Olmec, Mesoamerica's first great civilization. Based on the Gulf Coast side of Mexico's waste, on the other side of a range of low mountains from Oaxaca, the Olmec clearly understood the profound changes wreaked by maize. Indeed, they faded them in their art. Like the stained glass windows in European cathedrals, the massive Olmec sculptures and bas-reliefs were meant both to dazzle and instruct. A major lesson is the central place of maize, usually represented by a vertical ear with two leaves falling to the side, a talismanic symbol reminiscent of a fleur-de-lis. In sculpture after sculpture, ears of maize spring like thoughts from the skulls of supernatural beings. Olmec portraits of living rulers were often engraved on stelae, long flat stones mounted vertically in the ground and carved on the face with images and writing. In these stela portraits, the king's clothes, chosen to represent his critical spiritual role in the society's prosperity, generally included a headdress with an ear of maize emblazoned on the front like a star. So resonant was the symbol, according to Virginia M. Fields, curator of pre-Columbian art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, that in later Maya hieroglyphics, it became the semantic equivalent of the highest royal title, Ahau. In the Maya creation story, the famous Popol Vuh, humans were literally created from maize. Maize in the milpa slowly radiated throughout the Americas, stopping their advance only where the climate grew too cold or dry. By the time of the pilgrims, fields of mixed maize, beans, and squash lined the New England coast and in many places extended for miles into the interior. To the south, maize reached to Peru and Chile. Maize was a high-status food there, even though Andean cultures had developed their own agricultural system, with potatoes occupying the central role. Amazonia seems to have been an exception. Most, but not all researchers, believe maize there was eclipsed by manioc. Maize had an equivalent impact on much of the rest of the world after Columbus introduced it to Europe. Central Europeans became especially hooked on it. By the 19th century, maize was the daily bread of Serbia, Romania, and Moldavia. So dependent did northern Italy and southwestern France become on polenta, a type of cornmeal mush, that pellagra, caused by eating too much maize, became widespread. "I know little, if anything, pleasing to say about the people," wrote Goethe, who visited northern Italy in 1786. "The women's features indicated misery, and the children were just as pitiful to behold. The men are little better. The cause of this sickly condition is found in the continued use of Turkish and heath corn." Even greater was the impact in Africa, where maize was transforming agriculture by the end of the 16th century. The probability is that the population of Africa was greatly increased because of maize and other American Indian crops, Alfred Crosby told me. Those extra people helped make the slave trade possible. Other American Indian crops included peanuts and manioc, both now African staples. Maize swept into Africa as introduced disease was leveling Indian societies. Faced with a labor shortage, the Europeans turned their eyes to Africa. The continent's quarrelsome societies helped them siphon off millions of people. The maize-fed population boom, Crosby believes, let the awful trade continue without pumping the well dry. The stupidest question in the world. A few days after I met Ramirez Leyva, the tortilla entrepreneur, we went to Soledad Agua Blanca, a clump of small farms 2 hours southeast of Oaxaca City. Waiting for us at the side of the road was Hector Diaz Castellano, one of the farmers who supplied Ramirez Leyva's store. Diaz Castellano had a pencil mustache and a rakish straw hat. His Spanish was so heavily salted with Zapotec, the language of Oaxaca's biggest Indian group, that I could not make out a word of it. Ramirez Leyva had to translate. The maize field was at the end of a long, rutted dirt road that led up a rise. Although we had left just after dawn, the sun was hot enough by our arrival to make me wish for a hat. Diaz Castellano walked along the rows, his gaze taking in every stalk as he passed. For an hour he spoke, almost without stopping, about his maize and the market for his maize. He was not, I suspected, a naturally loquacious man, but that morning he had a subject that interested him. Diaz Castellanos' maize field was one of the 340,000 farms in Oaxaca. His farm, like about two-thirds of the farms in the state, occupied less than 10 acres, unviably small by the standards of developed nations. Most landrace maize is grown on these farms, partly because of tradition, and partly because they are usually in areas that are too high, dry, steep, or exhausted to support high-yield varieties, or owned by farmers too poor to afford the necessary fertilizer. As if being grown on tiny farms in bad conditions weren't enough, landrace maize is usually less productive than modern hybrids. A typical yield is 0.4 to 0.8 tons per acre, whereas Green Revolution varieties in Oaxaca reap between 1.2 and 2.5 tons per acre when properly fertilized, a crippling advantage. The meager harvest may be enough for subsistence, but can rarely be brought to market because farm villages are often hours away on dirt roads from the nearest large town. But even when farmers try, it is often little use. Modern hybrids are so productive that despite the distances involved, U.S. corporations can sell maize for less in Oaxaca than can Diaz Castellano. Landrace maize, he said, tastes better, but it is hard to find a way to make the quality pay off. He was lucky, he said, that Ramirez Leyva was trying to market his crop. We went to Diaz Castellano's house for breakfast. His wife Angelina, round and short-haired in a tight plaid dress, was cooking tortillas in an outdoor shed with corrugated aluminum walls. A wood fire burned beneath a concave clay griddle called a comal. The comal was propped above the flames on three rocks, a cooking method as old as Mesoamerican culture. By the fire, in a three-legged stone bowl, was a lump of fresh masa twice the size of a toaster. The stereotype is that rural Mexicans are generous to strangers. Piling my plate high, Angelina did nothing to dispel this impression. I asked her husband what he was. I wanted to find out which Indian group he was born into, but he took the question another way. Somos hombres de maíz, he said, enunciating clearly for my benefit. We are men of maize. I wasn't sure what to make of this gnomic utterance. Was he pulling my leg? Everybody says that, Ramirez Leyva said, observing my confusion. It's an idiom. A little while later, I visited a Danish anthropologist at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, CIMMET, outside Mexico City. Watching films of her interviews with Oaxacans, I saw two old women explain to the young anthropologist that they, too, were hombres de maíz. So Ramirez Leyva was right, I thought. A day later, a CIMMET biologist gave me a paperback book, describing it as the best novel ever written about Mesoamerica. It was Hombres de Maíz by Miguel Ángel Asturias. All right already, I thought. I get it. Meanwhile, Angelina had come out from behind the comal and joined her husband. In the Oaxacan countryside, they explained to me, a house without maize growing in the backyard is like a house without a roof or walls. You would never not have maize, they said. They were speaking matter-of-factly, as if telling me how to take the bus. Even in the city, they said, where people cannot grow maize, nobody would even think of passing a day without eating it. Curious, I asked what they thought would happen if they didn't have maize every day. Diaz Castellano looked at me as if I had asked the stupidest question in the world. "Why should I want to be somebody else?" he said. Chapter 7. Writing, Wheels, and Bucket Brigades. Tales of Two Civilizations, Part 2. Like grapes, they fall off. On January 16, 1939, Matthew W. Sterling took an early morning walk through the wet, buggy forest of Veracruz State, on the Gulf Coast side of Mexico's southern isthmus. 80 years before his walk, a villager traipsing through the same woods had stumbled across a buried, 6-foot-tall stone sculpture of a human head. Although the find was of obvious archaeological importance, the object was so big and heavy that in the intervening 8 decades, it had never been pulled out of the ground. Sterling, director of the Smithsonian Bureau of American Ethnology, had gone to Mexico the year before, in early 1938, to see the head for himself. He found it, sunk to the eyebrows in mud, after an 8-hour horseback ride from the nearest town. The head was in the midst of about 50 large, artificial earthen mounds, the ruins, Sterling concluded with excitement, of a previously unknown Maya civic center. He had decided to assemble a research team and explore the area in more detail the next year, and persuaded the National Geographic Society to foot the bill. When he returned to Veracruz, he and his team cleared the dirt around the great head, admiring its fine, naturalistic workmanship. So unlike the stiff, stylized sculpture common elsewhere in Mesoamerica. Nearby, they found a stela, its wide, flat face covered with bas-relief figures. Hoping to turn up others, Sterling was walking that January morning to the far end of the mounded area, where a workman had noticed a large, flat, partly submerged rock, a second stela. Accompanying him were 12 workers from the nearby hamlet of Tres Zapotes. They pried the stela from the ground with wooden poles, but it was blank. Disappointed, Sterling took the crew to yet a third fallen stela. They scraped away the covering dirt and found that it, like the first, was covered with intricate images. Alas, the carvings were now too weathered to be deciphered. The frustrated Sterling asked the workers to expose the back of the slab by digging beneath it and levering up the stone with poles. Several of the men, he later recounted, were on their knees in the excavation, cleaning the mud from the stone with their hands, when one of them spoke up in Spanish, "Chief, here are numbers." Across the back of the stela were clumps of dots and bars, a notation familiar to Sterling from the Maya. The Maya used a dot to signify 1 and a horizontal bar to signify 5. The number 19 would thus be 3 bars and 4 dots. Sterling copied the dots and bars and hurried back to camp, where we settled down to decipher them. The inscription turned out to be a date, September 3rd, 32 BC, in today's calendar. Sterling already knew that Tres Zapotes was anomalous. It was at least 150 miles west of any previously discovered Maya settlement. The date deepened the puzzle. If, as seemed likely, it recorded when the stela was put on display, this implied that Tres Zapotes had been a going concern in 32 BC, centuries before any other known Maya site. The date thus seemed to imply that the Maya had originated well to the west of what was thought of as their traditional homeland, and much earlier than had been thought. Sterling didn't believe it. Surely the Maya had not sprung up in Tres Zapotes and then moved en masse hundreds of miles to the east. But the alternative explanation, that Tres Zapotes was not a Maya community, seemed equally improbable. The Maya were universally regarded as the oldest advanced society in Mesoamerica. Whoever had carved the stela had some knowledge of writing and mathematics. If they were not Maya, the implication was that someone else had launched the project of civilization in Mesoamerica. Learning from local people that Tres Zapotes was only one of many mound sites in Veracruz, Stirling decided to return in 1940 to survey them all. The task was daunting, even for a cigar-chomping, whiskey-drinking, adventure addict like Stirling. Most of the mound centers were in the middle of trackless mangrove swamps, or up narrow, unmapped rivers choked with water hyacinth. Ticks and mosquitoes were indefatigable, and present in huge numbers. The ticks were worse than the mosquitoes, Stirling remarked, because they had to be dug out of the flesh with a knife. At one point, Stirling and a colleague hitched a ride in a pepper truck to one of the smaller sites. After jolting down a road with deep ruts, designed to test the very souls of motor cars, the two men were led off in a nondescript meadow. Stirling went to talk with the driver. "The ticks are not bad, are they?" I asked him hopefully, viewing the tall grass and underbrush between the road and the mounds. "No," said the driver, beaming. "When full, like grapes, they fall off and no harm is done. There are millions of them here, however." In La Venta, a dry raised island in the coastal swamp, Stirling's team discovered four more colossal heads. Like the first, they had no necks or bodies and wore helmets that vaguely resembled athletic gear. All were at least 6 feet tall and 15 feet round, and made from single blocks of volcanic basalt. How, Stirling wondered, had their makers transported these 10-ton blocks from the mountains and across the swamp? Whoever these people were, he eventually concluded, they could not be Maya. Their ways of life seemed too different. Instead, they must have belonged to another culture altogether. La Venta was filled with mounds and terraces, which told Stirling that many people had lived there. "The city," he wrote in 1940, "may well be the basic civilization out of which developed such high art centers as those of Maya, Zapotecs, Toltecs, and Totonacs." He called its mysterious people the Olmec. Stirling's account set the template for decades to follow. Ever since his day, the Olmec have been known by two Homeric epithets. They were mysterious, and they were the mother culture of Mesoamerica. Tourists are told by Frommer's 2010 Mexico Guide, for example, to visit the ruins of the enigmatic people who created the mother culture of Mesoamerica. But in recent years, many archaeologists have come to believe that neither description is correct. The Olmec's purported mysteriousness is related to their emergence. To Stirling and many of his successors, the Olmec seem to have no peers or ancestors. They appeared fully formed, apparently from nowhere, like Athena springing from the brow of Zeus. First there was a jungle with a few indistinguishable villages, then suddenly, a sophisticated empire with monumental architecture. Carved stelae, earthwork pyramids, hieroglyphic writing, ball courts, and fine artworks. All of it conjured into existence with the suddenness of a magician's trick. The Olmec, wrote Smithsonian archaeologist Betty Magers, were a quantum change. Their status as precursors led archaeologists to believe that the subsequent emergence of other complex societies was due to their example, or their conquest. Even the mighty Maya did little more than continue down the path set by the Olmec. There is now little doubt, Michael Coe, the Yale archaeologist, wrote in 1994, that all later civilizations in Mesoamerica, whether Mexican or Maya, ultimately rest on an Olmec base. Strictly speaking, Coe was mistaken. By the time he wrote, many of his colleagues strongly doubted that the Olmec either emerged alone or were the mother culture. They did emerge abruptly, these researchers say, but they were only the first of the half-dozen complex societies, sister cultures, that sprang up in southern Mexico after the development of maize agriculture. Focusing on the Olmec's chronological primacy, they believe, obscures the more important fact that Mesoamerica was the home of a remarkable multi-society ferment of social, aesthetic, and technical innovation. Rubber people. Nobody knows the right name for the Olmec, but Olmec is the wrong one. They spoke a language in the Mixoquian language family, some members of which are still used in isolated pockets of southern Mexico. Olmec, though, is a word in Nahuatl, the language of the Mexica to the north. It means, more or less, people of the land of rubber. The problem with the name is not so much that the Olmec did not use it for themselves. Nobody knows what that name was, and they have to be called something. Nor is the problem the rubber, which the Olmec used, and may have invented. Scientists discovered in the 1990s that they made rubber by chemically treating the latex-containing sap of Castilla elastica, the same tree later brutally harvested in the upper Amazon. The problem is that the Mexica did not actually use the name to refer to the putative mother culture in Veracruz, but to another, completely unrelated culture in Puebla to the west, a culture that, unlike the ancient Olmec, still existed at the time of the Spanish conquest. The confusion between the Mexica's Olmec and Sterling's Olmec led some archaeologists to propose that the latter should be called the La Venta culture, after the site he investigated. Almost everyone agreed that the new name was a big improvement, logically speaking. Unfortunately, nobody used it. Not for the first time in Native American history, the confusing, incorrect name prevailed. The Olmec heartland was the coastal forests of Veracruz. Compared to the Norte Chico, the area is promising. Like the Peruvian littoral, it is bracketed by sea and mountains, but it catches, rather than misses, the prevailing winds, and the rain that comes with them. The shoreline itself is swampy, but not far from the coast, the country rises into a lush, fertile plateau. Further inland are the Tuxtla Mountains, with many rivers cascading down their flanks. The rivers flood in the rainy season, enriching the land, Nile Delta style. During the rest of the year, the climate is drier, and farmers plant and tend their milpas on the alluvial soil. The first traces of the people who had become the Olmec date back to about 1800 BC. At that time, there was little to distinguish them from groups elsewhere in Mesoamerica. But something happened in Veracruz, some spark or incitement, a cultural quickening, because within the next three centuries, the Olmec had built and occupied San Lorenzo, the first large-scale settlement in North America. It covered 2.7 square miles. On a plateau commanding the Coatzacoalcos River Basin, San Lorenzo proper was inhabited mainly by the elite. Everyone else lived in the farm villages around it. The ceremonial center of the city, a series of courtyards and low mounds, the latter probably topped with thatch houses, sat on a raised platform 150 feet high and two-thirds of a mile to a side. The platform was built of almost 3 million cubic yards of rock, much of it transported from mountain quarries 50 miles away. Scattered around the San Lorenzo platform were stone monuments, massive thrones for living kings, huge stone heads for dead ones. Rulers helped to mediate between supernatural forces in the air above and the watery place below where souls went after life. When kings died, their thrones were sometimes transformed into memorials for their occupants, the colossal heads. The features of these enormous portraits are naturalistically carved, and amazingly expressive, thoughtful or fiercely proud, mirthful or dismayed. It is assumed they were placed like so many stone sentinels for maximum Orwellian impact. The king is here. The king is watching you. The statue's broad lips and flat noses have led Africanist historians like Clyde Winters and Ivan van Sertima to claim that the Olmecs either were visited by Africans or had actually migrated from Africa. The African knowledge gained thereby explains the Olmec's rapid rise. These views are not widely endorsed. Surprisingly, several noted archaeologists, including Betty Meagers and Gordon Ekholm, have suggested the geographical opposite, that Olmec society was inspired by China. Visitors from the Shang dynasty are said to have crossed the Pacific to teach the ancient Olmec how to write, build monuments, and worship a feline god. This hypothesis, too, has failed to stir enthusiasm. Like the carvings and stained glass windows in European cathedrals, the art in San Lorenzo and other Olmec cities consisted mainly of powerful recurring images. The crucifixions and virgins, so to speak, of ancient Mesoamerica. Among these repeated subjects is a crouched, blobby figure with a monstrously swollen head. Puzzled researchers long described these sculptures as dwarves or dancers. In 1997, an archaeologist and a medical doctor with archaeological leanings identified them as human fetuses. Their features were portrayed accurately enough to identify their stage of development. Researchers had not recognized them because artistic renditions of fetuses are almost unheard of in European cultures. The first known drawing of one is by Leonardo. Other frequent themes included lepers, the pathologically obese, and people with thyroid deficiencies, all portrayed with a cool eye for anatomical detail. Perhaps the best-known subject is a man or boy gingerly holding a were-jaguar, a limp, fat, sexless baby with a flattened nose and a snarling jaguar mouth. Often the baby has a deeply cloven skull. The denizens of San Lorenzo are unlikely to have shared Europeans' dismay at the physical deformity portrayed in these images. Indeed, by contemporary standards, high-born Olmec were deformed themselves. By binding small, flat pieces of wood to newborns' foreheads, they pushed up the soft infant bones, making the skull longer and higher than normal. To further proclaim their status, wealthy Olmec carved deep grooves into their teeth and pierced their nasal septums with bone awls, plugging the holes with ornamental jade beads. Because no Olmec skeletons have been found, no direct proof of these practices exists. Instead, archaeologists base their beliefs on the portrayal of Olmec nobles in figurines and sculptures. Swanning about the elite precincts, the rich and powerful wore finely woven clothing, but only below the waist. Breech clouts for men, skirts and belts for women. Veracruz was too hot for anything more. On public occasions, nobles bedizened themselves with bracelets, anklets, many-stranded necklaces, bejeweled turbans, and big, hip-hop-style pendants. Some of the last were concave mirrors made from beautifully polished magnetite. Precisely ground, the mirrors were able to start fires and project images onto flat surfaces, camera lucida fashion. Presumably, they were used to dazzle hoi polloi. As for the poor, it is likely that they went naked, except possibly for sandals. San Lorenzo fell in about 1200 BC, victim of either revolution or invasion. Or perhaps it was abandoned and sacked for religious reasons. Archaeologists have advanced several hypotheses for the city's demise. What is certain is that the site was vacated and the stele defaced and the sculptures decapitated. The colossal heads being, so to speak, pre-decapitated. They were smashed with hammers and systematically buried in long lines. Vegetation overran the red ochre floors and the workshops that manufactured ceramic figurines and iron beads and rubber axe head straps. Olmec society was surprisingly unaffected by the collapse of its greatest polity. A much bigger city, La Venta, was going up on a swamp island about 40 miles away. Today, La Venta is partly buried by an oil refinery. But in its heyday, roughly speaking, 1150 BC to 500 BC, it was a large community with a ring of housing that surrounded a grand ceremonial center. The city's focus, its Eiffel Tower or Tiananmen Square, was a 103-foot-tall clay mound, a bulging, vertically fluted cone somewhat resembling a head of garlic. The mound rose at the south end of a rectangular, 100-yard-long pavilion that was bordered by two knee-high berms. At the north end of the pavilion was a sunken, rectangular courtyard fenced on three sides by a row of 7-foot basalt columns atop a low red and yellow adobe wall. The fourth, northern side, opened onto a third mound, larger than the small mound, but nowhere near the size of the big one. The pavilion and courtyard had painted walls and floors of colored sand and clay. Heavy sculptural objects, including several of the trademark heads, studded the area. The central part of the city was reserved, archaeologists believe, for clerics and rulers. It was Buckingham Palace and the Vatican rolled into one. Laventa too was destroyed, perhaps deliberately, around 350 BC. But its 800-year existence spanned one of the most exciting times